This is Melissa, and it is the 28th of September, 2025. I hope that you're all doing well. I had given thought to what I could put up for you, and I had a few ideas, and then just ended up discarding them. We had I'm recording this on Saturday evening, and we had our book club meeting today on Telegram, unrecorded conversation, and Fiona really led this with a great idea to get everyone talking by asking how they had discovered Alan Watts' work. And it was such an interesting thing to hear from everyone, humbling and amazing and inspiring. And it put me in a different frame of mind. And I mentioned on the Real History that I put up Thursday that I had an outing, I saw real people, and I was just in a kind of slowed down frame of mind. And after the book club, well, ordinarily, the me I know would have leapt up and gone into action on the Redux, and instead I took a nap. And when I woke up from the nap just about half an hour ago, I just had a different idea in my head. And the words that came into my mind were patchwork quilt. The talks of Alan's that I listened to this week were in September. And it's not that September is such a special month, but it is one of those months for me that seem to go by a little more quickly. Sometimes February does that. But September, wherever I have been in my life, there are weather changes. Even if it's still quite hot, the days are getting shorter. And if it's hot, it's still cooler somehow, even if that just means at night. And in Canada, it meant we had to hustle to get the wood in, that hopefully we were pretty well done with that. But I might still be stacking, and the worst case scenario is Alan might still be splitting and I would be stacking. So, and this would be the case even after he was hospitalized in 2016. And from that point, we really relied on the wood that we bought and brought in. There would still be some splitting involved, and there was certainly stacking involved. So here in Texas, without a wood-burning stove as my source of heat, it's different, but it's still a real strong awareness that the seasons are changing. And what has happened for me this year is it has slowed me down. It wasn't just going to see the book club member and having barbecue. It wasn't just the information overload that seemed to get really heightened in the U.S. for the last couple of weeks. It's just maybe everything all at once. I received an email from a listener who said, well, you know, Alan always signed off from Hamish and myself, from me and Hamish, it's good night and may your God or gods go with you. And I would love it if you would talk some about your experiences with Hamish or what Alan thought about Hamish. And the email, it brought up a lot of memories. Some of them were sad and some were wonderful. But it did remind me that Hamish died on September 15, 2016. So again, September. And I do, you know, there's always joy and sadness when you remember what is no longer. And I have some cute pictures of Hamish and pictures I took, but It makes me sad in a way that I don't have pictures of Hamish in the beautiful coats that I made for him. But I do have the coats, and I thought maybe if I have time tonight, I'll snap a picture of these coats, because there's Hamish in a silly blue coat by the woodpile. It's a lightweight one, and I made him his spring and autumn coat, which was not super heavy, but it was heavy enough. I mean, it was wool and it was lined. And then I made him his winter coat, and that I actually quilted. And I've never quilted anything in my life. And the way that I did this was I cut up sweaters, or what the English and the Irish and Scottish called pullovers, or sometimes they're called jerseys, but I think jumpers is what Ellen called them. That was funny, but I think I heard Nick Hayes say jumper the other day, and that's a sweater in the U.S. So I cut up some old sweaters, and then I lined Hamish's coat with that. And then the quilting that I did was really just running a stitch, and you kind of had that pocket quilted look with it. It was, I don't know, but I'm not a seamstress, but I did it with love, and they're neat coats. And I made Hamish his comfortable beds. And so he was the best dog, or pooch, as Alan called him. He had the best temperament. He was a big dog and a mix, but he was just a sweet, always sweet and always happy, and very much, I mean, he loved me, and I took him on many, I would say, many, many, many walks, and often without Alan, who would be busy at his desk, and we took him out together, and Alan liked to play Frisbee with him, and he was just family, and losing him was devastating. It was very hard on Alan, and it was hard on me. And Alan, he said, you can't be falling apart over this. I was thinking about that too this week. No matter what was going on, Alan was always saying, don't fall apart. And so I never fell apart. But Hamish, you just couldn't ask for a better dog. He was the best. And I miss him, and I miss Alan. And so September 15, 2016. And the house was very quiet after that, because Hamish was just a tail wagging. He wasn't a noisy dog, although I will share this. I certainly wish that I had video or audio of Alan playing the harmonica. Because if you wanted Hamish to talk, then Alan playing the harmonica would get Hamish to talk. And he sometimes did that just for the fun of it. And Hamish would actually kind of howl to the harmonica. Something came up last week, too. I had said something about bridging emotion and reason. And I had a couple of email exchanges with someone, a man, who was saying, well, one of the problems with men is that they've neutered us, and they've, touchy-feely, get in touch with your emotions, and kind of an emasculation. But I don't agree with that. I don't think that what was promoted, you could say from the 1960s on, these touchy-feely kind of, well, I don't even, encounter groups. I think they used to call them encounter groups, where you got in touch with your emotions. I don't even think that's certainly not what I'm talking about with emotion. I think definitely where I'm headed with this is more the bridging of the left and the right hemisphere, the parable of Plato's parable of the charioteer, the left and the right brain, that both are working together. And I hopefully in this patchwork quilt, I'll be able to find a place where Alan was talking about just that a similar thing there, that it that is the completion. That was what the elite considered the completion of man, but they were a lot more deviant than that in their thinking. But it is where you see more because your brain is fully functioning. And this can be a hard thing when there's layer upon layer of indoctrination that we're working through, to even be able to glimpse that there is a different way that your brain could be working. But in the book club today, at the culmination, when everyone had done this amazing sharing of discovering Alan's work, and then I was talking, I realized I was getting emotional, and I apologized. Oh, I don't want to get emotional. And I think I kind of made myself laugh a little bit, as I will, a defense mechanism. And I got a private message back from someone who said, and, you know, I understand that, because, you know, emotions make you vulnerable. And then you consider that to be a sign of weakness, and nobody wants to be weak, certainly not in this system. But it is emotions that make us human. And really, that's what I'm driving at, is seeing things differently because the whole of your mind and brain are engaged in what it is that you're looking at. But it is what distinguishes us from the machine. We are not artificial intelligence, but hopefully real intelligence. And this seems to be, for me, what is at stake. In the real history that I put up on Thursday, I know some of you will listen to me on the Redux, but you don't listen to the real history, and that's fine. But I do want to point out that I think that between... I was talking by myself, but I really was speaking about ideas and things that I had discovered because of a phone call I got from Joe. And Joe, his wife had listened to an interview between someone named Patrick Bet-David and Nick Fuentes. And she wasn't home when he called. She had gone to the gym, and he tried to text her to find out what was it, you know, what was the university that you heard. But he thought she'd really gotten on to something, because she had noticed there that Nick was saying that he had gone through something, and also Charlie Kirk had. So she didn't return the text. She was busy getting a workout. And so he and I went through a little bit of sleuthing online, and we discovered that probably what she was talking about, what seemed to be mentioned, was Leadership Institute. And this was something that both Charlie Kirk and Nick Fuentes had gone through. And for us, this was just a real-time, in-the-moment confirmation of what Alan Watt always told us, which is our leaders are supplied. So I can't say that in these talks of Alan's, these bits that I'm going to play you from September, it was just the mood that I was in. It's the mood I'm in this last week of more reflection and remembering Hamish, and remembering Alan, of course, always, but just thinking about September and season changes and shorter days. And sometimes that means that your work is truncated as well. Your days are shortened. Your work day might get shortened. You get into a different rhythm. And I often find that I go into a different rhythm kind of kicking and resisting instead of just going with it, because I always have to, and I must, and should. And the rhythm that takes over, that certainly took over for me last week, is no, that's nope, we're slowing down, like it or not. In one of these talks that I'm going to put up, and I'll just mention that for the visual people, I'll try to supply a quick little photo of what you're looking at. And for those who only listen to the audio, I will supply, if there is a transcript that is available, I will link to that. But I'll really quickly tell you right now that I think that you're going to get part of a Jackie Petru. This turned out to be the last interview that he did with her, September 28, 2006. And there, I think I'm going to give you a snippet from September 28, 2007, and possibly something from September 28, 2009. And then branching further out in September, I liked something that he said with George Butler on World Review Commentary. This was September 2, 2007, and he talked about First Global Revolution. Nick Hayes has been covering this. I don't know if these videos will go up, but he's been covering them in a live book club every Wednesday. And this is the book that that Alan quoted from many times, not just this one snippet, but certainly this bit is very important. It's from page 115 of the Club of Rome's The First Global Revolution. I think that was 1973. Sorry, I didn't look up the date, but I may in just a second here. The common enemy of humanity is man. In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. In their totality and in their interactions, these phenomena do constitute a common threat which demands the solidarity of all peoples. But in designating them as the enemy, we fall into the trap about which we have already warned, namely, mistaking symptoms for causes. All these dangers are caused by human intervention, and it is only through changed attitudes and behavior that they can be overcome. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself. And we are all around us being treated as the real enemy. Just this week in the UK, Keir Starmer says people will not be able to work in UK without digital ID. And this is the, say they have flooded the country and all the countries, the United Kingdom, they have flooded with illegal aliens. They have opened it up by design, and Alan Watt has pointed this out for years, since before Tony Blair. This says, can we say how many people come to the UK illegally and work here? One reason behind the government's plan to introduce digital ID cards is to help tackle illegal working. The so-called informal economy, made up of people and businesses operating outside official employment and tax systems, has been cited as one factor attracting people to the UK without legal permission. Prime Minister Keir Starmer has said that removing this pull factor could help deter people from making irregular journeys to the UK, such as crossing the Channel in small boats. But this is what he said. I don't see it in this particular article, but I've seen in other places he said, if you do not have this digital ID, you will not work in the UK. That's how clearly he said it. Read his lips. And Neil Foster sent me an article. I'm due to be talking to him in a little over a week for our monthly Real History. And I'm sure we'll cover this in more detail. But he sent me an article from Farming UK, Westminster, to hear farming blueprint to produce more from less. So Westminster is going to hear a radical new agenda for UK farming, aiming to increase food production by 30% while halving agriculture's environmental footprint by 2050. Now, we know that this isn't possible, that in 22 years or 24 years, they are going to cut in half the environmental footprint while increasing food production by 30%. One of the things that was so inspiring about the book club today was people talking about living, I don't want to make a trite thing here, but living in solutions comes to mind, where as individuals, they're making individual choices to make their life better. And some of those individual choices include participating in creation of community. But there is a woman in book club who is German and lives in Croatia. I think I actually shared some poetry that she sent. It was not her poetry, but it fit in with something I put up a while back. And a lovely person with a beautiful farm. And she made the comment in the book club that she realizes now that she's roughly 80% food independent. And that is so inspiring to hear. So I know that Alan didn't want to be gloom and doom, and I don't either. This situation, if I want to call it that, this psychological operation, this torture around all of the different stories of Charlie Kirk and why it's playing out. Someone commented today in an email, and I won't share the entirety of the email, but they were just reminding me that they had written to Alan before and said they're going to go for the 1930s scenario all over again. And that's going to be lining up what you might call the hordes behind, the anti-Zionism movement. And then you're going to get all of the leftist propaganda, you could even say leftist Russian propaganda. And people are being divided up with very clear talking points. And it brings up things that I mentioned in The Real History, which is nationalism versus internationalism and Christian nationalism and fascism. And all of these things are not happening from the grass up, from the ground up. These movements and dissatisfactions come top down. And this person who wrote in said the final solution to the eternal 1930s is the brain chip. That's their plan. And certainly we know that Alan Watt had a lot to say about the brain chip. And so, but like I said, like where I was heading there is I don't want to be gloom and doomer, and neither did Alan. That if we didn't think that it was possible for individuals to break free, he wouldn't have been talking, and I wouldn't be carrying on now. So that is enough for me, and I wish you all to have a good week. When I speak to you again, it will be October. Red October, the month of revolution, and it's kind of in one of these, I may highlight it if I can find it, but in one of the talks that I plan to snip from in September, Alan mentioned to a caller, he said, I don't like October, it's, and then he explained it's a month that lots of things are pulled on the public. But then again, they do that in September. We had 9/11, and now they've given us, just in case 9/11 wasn't whipping us up into a frenzy, Charlie Kirk. And really, the war is on us. Man is the enemy 24/7, every day of the year. but we overcome by retaining our humanity, our emotions, our love for one another, our love for our pets, growing our own food. So all of that is good. I wish you to have a good week and take care. I'll be back.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us tonight here on Sweet Liberty. It is Thursday, and it is the 28th of September in the year 2006. We're on not usually Thursday nights, as you know. Last night, Alan was our guest, and we were in a conversation, and I hoped that we would be able to pick it up this evening. I don't know where it's going to go. I don't know. We never know anyway, do we, Alan?
It's a long and winding road.
It's a long and winding road and a wheel within a wheel. Mm-hmm. And when we were closing last night, Alan, my parting comments, I believe, you know, we have, since 1998, have been on the air together a lot, and of course the history that you have given us and the people whose eyes have been opened because of the information that has been imparted. And the one thing for me that has been missing, as I said last night, it feels that each program, at least part of each program, someplace in it, would touch on the spiritual issues. Because we have touched on so much. I mean, there has been a lot of conversation about religion, and you have said without any qualms, without any ifs, ands, or buts, all religions are man-made, and they were made by man to control the minds, the beliefs, and therefore the behavior of people. And the people who have listened, many of our listeners have begun to realize that the religion that they have selected or were born into has been a lie. And it's, as I said, it's left a lot of people. And I don't have a count. By phone calls that I've received, letters that I've received, but mostly phone calls, now that I'm not doing shortwave anymore, people feeling lost, floundering, literally, because they realize the religion, the lies that religions have been teaching, and yet what is there for somebody to hold on to? What is there for somebody, and not another myth, you see? And that's why I ask if we could pick this up tonight. I don't know where we're going to go with it or what you would be willing to talk about.
You've got it's a quandary, really, for people, because they generally jump out of one religion into another.
I know that.
That standard path that they take. And yet, as I keep saying over and over, if this is the place where matter and spirit meet, and since this is a very important place for it to happen, since it's the only place for it to happen, therefore, what you do in this life is of utmost importance. Therefore, you find your way towards one by living in the other. You work your way towards something which comes with time, if you're doing all the right things, which generally are not just for yourself. You help yourself as a side effect of doing the right things. And it's a complete re-evaluation of everything which you held dear previously. The old story about dying the death to be reborn, well, it was an ancient saying. And it's ancient, and it's modern at the same time, because it's the same path everyone must take, at least to start off with, where you truly look around all the things that you've chased all your life. The young ones are being chased to go after the same things at the moment, and you for the first time truly evaluate them, and you make a distinguishing line between one and the other, what truly is important in this life. And quite a few years ago, you remember, a guy phoned me in. And, oh no, he phoned, I think. And he said, you've got to get a computer around. He says, this has become my best friend, my therapist has become everything to me. And I said to him, you'll lose yourself in the process. I said, because, it says, you can die, and you can have that glass screen next to you as you're dying, but personally, I'd rather have a human hand holding mine.
Yes.
So, we're caught up in a time where science has become the sub-god, you might say, of this system. We've all been trained that if an expert says something in a white coat, then it's the gospel truth. And yet science is taking us into a form of oblivion for ourselves, albeit it'll be almost a painless one eventually, as people go through the changes. They're already adapting to them. But we're losing every single thing, the uniqueness of being human in the process.
And what is the uniqueness?
And that's the question that people have to ask themselves. Do they want to go on this path that's already been chosen by the elite for us, or are they going to start now and standing up and saying no?
Saying no to what's happening?
That's a personal choice.
Is that what you're saying?
To where we're being directed, yeah. We have lost so many things just in the last 50 years that we used to call our humanity. We have lost the sacredness of life, number one. That's why it was always held up, even in the courts they had to hold it up, because of the religious traditions, which at least had that correct, that life itself was a sacred thing. We've watched ourselves being allowed. We've actually helped and enabled it to happen.
How?
All the way to abortion.
How have we helped and enabled it, Alan?
Pardon?
How have we helped and enabled it?
Because our own drives, we're told, unshackle your drives, let them go. You don't have to hold them back anymore. You don't have to be morally or personally responsible for your drives.
Well,
that was the first part.
Yeah, but...
And then it was encouraged from the top. It was called the sexual revolution. And the sexual revolution was do your own thing. There's something there to take care of any fallout. Don't worry, just do it. Then the next part, of course, we've already seen the business that's been flourishing quietly, now it's in the open, to do with body parts and stem cells. It's a flourishing business.
I know it is, but what does this have to do
and
with...
And we think, and we graze all through this, accepting it, until it's now normal.
Welcome again to another segment of The Grassy Knoll on this September 28, 2006. And we have with us today Alan White. He's been on a number of times before. The website is cuttingthroughthematrix.com. We'll talk about all that later. But we thank you for coming back again, Alan, and I hope everything's okay above the 48th parallel.
Yes, it is. It's very busy right now. I'm getting the last of the wood in for the winter.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I was going to ask you how many inches you get on the ground yet, but that's a little premature, isn't it?
Well, we've got lots of rain at the moment.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have a look at these guys today, did you?
Yeah, I saw them spraying. They're spraying heavily into the clouds and bringing the rain on. That's why everybody's got sinusitis.
Well, we came out this morning, and if you didn't know what they do, when they do it pre-dawn, it really does look like cirrus cloud.
It truly does, yeah.
Yeah. Now, the other person you mentioned being a product of a think tank and being intelligence was Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
He also apparently voiced his discontent, and can we assume that his motorcycle accident might have been a little murky?
Yeah, he was on a Rudge motorcycle, and he traveled the road many, many times, and a hay cart pulled out supposedly from a field, which is certainly plausible, and he hit it. But it is known that he knew too much. He had been recruited at Cambridge along with 20 other famous students that became very famous in history, and trained in Aramaic languages, and set off to the Middle East to set up newspapers to start giving out new propaganda to the Arabs to get them ready for a new system. And he simply knew too much. Yeah.
Well, in that case then, you've seen the movie, have you not?
I saw the movie, but his book that he wrote himself, it was called Seven Pillars of Wisdom, and it's worth the read.
Okay, and that chronicles the whole experience and, of course, his attitude and assessment of what was going on there.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Also, moving into what would be the first thing that came to my mind watching the video, and this is Reality Check Part 2.
Uh-huh.
You mention oftentimes about the priesthood,
mm-hmm.
and I'm thinking it's priesthood kind of in quotation marks.
Yeah.
Were the priests, from the beginning of whenever,
mm-hmm.
were they mostly not so much spiritual individuals, but maybe faking it, as they were what would be akin to mob bosses?
Yeah, I think really they came out after studying. Now, there's different theories on it. There's some hints and clues in their own inner religion as to who they are, because they have deviances of all kinds. And there's a hint that they were the ones who rebelled against nature, you might say, the natural way of people and tribal systems. And at one time they were killed off within tribes. And then, as people began to feel more civilized, as we call it, they would save their lives and they'd literally guard them, put them inside caves. And from then, they grew and grew, and they observed the people below, their habits, their behavior, because the first thing you have to understand to conquer a people, you have to study their nature, and then you can manipulate it. They studied the stars, the movements, and when they came down, they could tell the people when to plant, when to grow, because they knew the solar, lunar, and stellar times. All sciences, you might say, they studied. And then they brought in a thing called commerce and money.
So then you're saying that the priests attain their status because they did kind of get it, and they had some kind of... Not, I wouldn't say secret knowledge, but something certainly that wasn't being passed down to the peasants.
Yeah, it was the first thing they had to find out was the human nature, simply observation. Observation, detailing, and watching to see if every generation would repeat the same behavior. Then you can manipulate it.
Welcome to the World Review Commentary. This is your host, George Butler, broadcasting from Austin, Texas. We're actually South Austin, Texas. Our program is every Sunday morning between 10 a.m. and 12 a.m. This morning we have a very insightful guest. Alan Watt is his name, and he can describe this matrix that we get caught up in and we get entangled by. And you can bet that he's got one of the finest insights that I've ever encountered in the radio or internet and in this world. Welcome to our program, Alan Watt.
It's a pleasure to be on here, yeah.
I tell you, you relate your experiences from early childhood. Is that what happened? You started waking up pretty early about the world in general?
Yeah, I did. I did. I saw it all around me, in fact, growing up in Britain. The place that supposedly ran a good part of the globe, the empire, and the sun never set on the British Empire, as they say. And I wondered why pretty well everybody I knew was poor. If all this money was coming in corporate, that all this natural resources to plunder across the planet, how come only a few hundred families in London seem to benefit and hold on to it down through the generations? And I thought about all the manpower, all the labor, every hour of labor that had ever been done over the centuries. How come those who did all the labor had nothing? It just didn't tally up to me. And so very early on, I approached teachers, and I was only 5 and 6, but I asked for an adult library card, and they did have talks with me, and eventually I was approved. So I got into the adult libraries and the reference libraries in the big towns. And they had old books there going back sometime to the 1700s for the reference library. And I read history as it was being made at the time and recorded at the time. And then, of course, back at school, I was getting a completely different version of history taught to me. And when I brought up the facts to the teachers, they were stumped because they themselves had been given a different form of history. So I realized that George Orwell eventually, later on when I read his books, was quite correct, that truth goes down the memory hole with every generation as they rewrite history and give you a new fiction for your reality that will be your life, basically, where you'll argue about all the basic problems, which are really a sideshow. And the politics itself is called party politics because that's what it is. It's a party. It's balloons and trumpets and whistles. It's a party. It's a sideshow for the public because that's how we're in fact run.
I bet you had some interesting conversations in those classrooms when you were in school, right?
It was.
Well, there's some really lively confrontations. Tell us about one of those maybe that you can remember the best.
Well, you see, what I didn't know at the time, until a bit later, about a year later, and this was when I was about 7, I was still studying, and I found that England, the English educational system, had mandated that all of the discordant parts of history to do with Scotland and Ireland were to be removed from the history books. And yet here I was going into the reference libraries, looking at the stuff written at the time, and incredible slaughters that went on through those countries mandated by London. And I could see why they'd removed it from the later books for a harmony, as they call it, like you have harmony. And, of course, when I brought this up in the schools and I was giving them dates and massacres and slaughters and so on of the Scots and the Irish, the teachers were totally stumped. They hadn't been taught that themselves. And I never thought of going into the very old books to find out. So we had discussions in the classroom. I was up in front of the headmaster many, many times because I was giving out this information in class and I was going against what was the mandate of the educational authorities, which was to pacify the public and give them a fake history for harmony's sake.
Boy, you really, I tell you what, I guess there were always people whispering behind your back like, oh, he's a nutcase or his history is all distorted. Did you get some feedback from several friends that, like, from your community like that?
I got not so much discordancy. I did get curiosity because, in fact, some of the older counselors there, I remember meeting them to stop me in the street and they'd start questioning me. At that time, of course, I didn't realize that even the structure I was living in was a gang-oriented structure because all the respectable people in the area, the Catholics, the Protestant leaders, and so on, all belonged to their own Freemasonic associations. But the people at the top of those associations would stop me and quiz me and talk maybe for an hour or two sometimes. They never came down on me. They were curious as to what made my mind.
So they treated you fairly well in that community, and they knew you were on a mission, on a crusade for truth, right? Is that how they sort of begin to see you in your community?
Yes, they did. I was certainly odd. They couldn't. Some of them were a bit scared of me because I never lost the arguments, even with the adults. Like, I had the facts to back me up.
Well, you were unsettling then, and they're in this little comfort zone. It's like a cocoon, is it not? Maybe. Where people fall into this comfort and they have jobs and they have worldviews and they have religions and they sort of lose sight of seeking the truth.
They do. In fact, that's one of the major things I stumbled across was how all mammals are warned by one or more parents of those things they should be wary of, things that were dangerous to them. And I realized that humans were the same. And if your parents did not know truth, or what you should be worried about, they can't pass on that information. So the young mammal, the child, grows up thinking that the world that he's in is quite natural. It must have evolved that way. It never dawns on them that it's been planned that way. And that's how simple it is. You're made to accept the world as it's presented to you in every generation. And Lenin mentioned this as well. He said, there are 1,000 directions that society could go as a structure. But he says that the public must not be allowed to know that. They must think that the one they're born into is the only natural one there is.
These world sorcerers, I guess, could be described in that way, or are into creating more of a collective community, a collective political group, so
yes,
that they can more easily control. What are your thoughts on that?
There's plenty of evidence there. It's published, in fact, by many of the big think tanks, but run by think tanks. There are sections and specialized think tanks that run all parts of our lives and culture. Even when our culture is changing, these are the guys that plan the changes, including the music and the drama and what kind of games you'll be playing on the internet and so on. And the Club of Rome was one of the biggest clubs formed for the globalist society, again directed out of London. And their job was, as a premier think tank, was to look to the future that they wanted to bring about and see how they could bring it around. They market their ideas to the lesser think tanks that then work out the problems in how to market right to the people's minds. And the Club of Rome, in their own book, written by the two founders, is called The First Global Revolution. It says, they said that they had sought out a way to unify the world, and that because of history, the only time that people worked together cohesively and unitedly was when there's war. Therefore, to get the people in a global society to obey the new system, which was also to take over all resources and put them under the auspices of the United Nations, all food, all water, etc., under the United Nations, they said they would need a new enemy, and they thought about all the tricks they could pull to convince the world and panic them to make them obey and go along with this agenda. They thought about the space alien idea. Would that work? Could they pay enough science fiction writers to scare us all about UFOs and so on? And then they hit upon the idea of using the weather as the big enemy, and then ultimately mankind himself is the enemy, and therefore we'd have to change our whole way of living because we were altering the weather. So that's where they came up as an idea. It wasn't true, but it was a good idea, and with enough publicity and marketing through big foundations and agencies and media, they could make the public believe it. And that's in their own book. They admit that openly.
Yeah,
that's how simple it is. We are run by super think tanks, all working for the Royal Institute for International Affairs in London, which job is to bring about a global system. Alan Watt back with Cutting Through the Matrix. Telling you about the upcoming October exercise, huge exercise to be carried out in Canada and the States, with other countries joining in. Britain and some European countries too are doing a similar exercise to try and, as I say, contain whole populations. Because the first thing people will do if they hear of a plague coming or an outbreak in a certain area is to try to flee and get away from them. And of course, under NATO charter, it's all been signed by every participating country, all of these countries, US, Canada, etc., they've all agreed to contain whole populations within cities due to an infection or even the contamination from a nuclear fallout occur. And anyone trying to leave those areas during such times is to be shot on sight. Whole groups of people who are trying to get out to be bombed from the air, from helicopters with CS gas. That's official. That's the NATO plan. And that was signed back in the early 70s. It's still in operation today. So this whole containment type exercise to do with terror everywhere, I think is also part of the coming plagues, which they will use. It's the most efficient method for gradually bringing down a population and making sure that everyone obeys during this fear type scenario. But October, I don't like the month October, because look down through history at all the big revolutions that happen in October, like the Red Revolution. They do love October because October is the month for the Orionids, the meteor shower that comes around from the direction of Orion, not from Orion, but from that direction. And it's always been used in the high occult for advancing wars, etc., big changes. And it's not UFOs hiding behind them either, as some talk show hosts always bring out every year, which if you tune into some of them, I'm sure you know who I mean. There was mention, oh, there's UFOs hiding behind these meteor showers, these strange meteor showers. Well, there's nothing strange about them. They happen every year in October. And don't let the Mickey be pulled out of you. However, to use October for such an exercise is rather ominous. Now, I think we have Robert from New York on the line. Are you there, Robert?
Hello?
Hello, Robert.
Hello, Alan. Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm just calling because I had heard on one of your blurbs almost a year ago now how you were against, how you heard from young people that they were using psychedelic substances to achieve enlightenment or understanding or whatnot, and that you were pretty much against that as an avenue for understanding. And I was wondering if that still remains to be in your case.
Well, I don't care really what other people do, but I do know that Britain, for instance, has run what you think of as the New Age since they gave us the New Age. And MI5 and MI6 have come out officially and admitted they put out Aleister Crowley to start the OTO, the Ordo Templi Orientis, and to start pushing the use of drugs for alternate experiences. It was part of a guise and a plan. And we also know from Peter Wright, for instance, who worked for MI5 and who wrote the book Spycatcher, who was put on trial for disclosing a lot of information when Maggie Thatcher was in power. Peter Wright also talked about that they had been trying different psychedelic drugs to find if they could drug the whole population, especially the youth, who would be so fascinated by all their alternate experiences that they wouldn't really care what was happening in real life around them. And that actually does happen. I do remember the drug scene back in the 70s. I was at the tail end of the 60s. I remember that too. Some of my friends died with it. I saw friends walk out windows and drop two floors to their deaths. I saw people who never recovered from LSD trips who were then diagnosed with drug-induced schizophrenia for life. I also know in post-mortem that if you go into the ventricles of the brain and heavy drug users, even cannabis too, you'll find that they have been expanded and the cells round about them have died off. And you've got to ask yourself, why, oh, why, oh, why would the big boys at the top be pushing these particular methods on the young? That's your first clue that there's something wrong when they're pushing it. When LSD first came out, there were limos going around the big universities in Britain and in the States throwing garbage bags full of free LSD to get it all started up. And that came from big drug companies. We find, too, that you'll find Victor Rothschild, who was a scientist, he was a physicist, who was in charge of porting down bacterial, viral, and chemical warfare facilities for England. In fact, he ended up being in charge of the whole security at the tail end of the Cold War over all the organizations. He was personally experimenting using LSD on agents, on MI5 agents, and Peter Wright also wrote about that. So when the big boys push it, you've got to ask, what are they really up to? And I've seen enough strung-out people, as I say, yeah, they could go wow, wow, wow about all their experiences, and they're totally oblivious to the real things that were happening around them, including their own lives going down the tubes. But as far as anybody wanting to use it themselves, that really is up to them. Yeah. And this last week or two, I've been talking about reality and how most folk don't know what reality is. They all agree on a common reality, but it's the one that's been given to them. It's their Plato's cave that's been constructed for them by, you know, the big priesthood up in the clouds with the angels called the experts. They said they would do this in the time of John Dewey and many others of his ilk at the time. And they've actually implemented it. They've given us a fake reality. Most folk think that everything that comes from that television set on the news is true. They don't question it at all. In fact, they'd be astonished, and they are astonished, to think that they could be lied to, because no one would go to such lengths
to create such incredible big lies. That's why it works so well. They understand themselves with little white lies, etc., but they can't imagine people pulling out these massive whoppers and big foundations and NGOs all protesting for weather and climate change and so on. They can't imagine people go to such lengths. But that's how it really is, because you see, the followers of the greening agenda, the followers, I say, are even more brainwashed than the general public. They've had a more selective, directed indoctrination for this new green world religion that's to rule us all in the place of all the old religions that ruled us all. Science is behind it, of course, and the new priesthoods of the greening are the experts, the scientists. They don't even have to name them anymore, just experts, and that's good enough. And the public accept it quite happily. It's a world where when they bring in all of the Soviet and Hitler eugenic plan that they didn't create, came from Britain long before they turned up. And we'll go into some of this when I get back from this break. Hi, folks. I'm Alan Watt, and we're cutting through the matrix, talking about reality again, and how people all believe the same thing, really, and that's their download from television media. And that is why you have news anchors who are kept on the job way past retirement age, because you grew up with them, and they're sort of father figures, sometimes mother figures, and they'd never lie to you. A great amount of propaganda, image-making, image-building, has gone into creating these personalities as trustworthy. They even have ads on. Even the CBC, government-owned station, has ads on telling you that Mr. Mansbridge is the most trusted newscaster in Canada. Well, no one that I know has ever met the guy. We don't even know what he's like. We have his TV persona. That's it. But that's how you create images for television. Everything today is for television imaging, including presidents and prime ministers with their sound bits and their little photo ops, that kind of thing. Nothing is really real. It's all rehearsed, planned by, again, their experts in that particular field. A world run by experts. And then tidy part of the problem is we're the leftover of the remnant of an old age, and they're bringing in the new age. The planned society, an upgraded Stalinism, an upgraded type of Nazi system, combined together, a new, it's actually a form of feudalistic society that Professor Quigley talks about. He says the CEOs of international corporations, which are on board with government, completely tied together, they're the new overlords of this new system. And they must get a tidy society. They must eliminate the weak, the infirm, those with hereditary diseases, all of the things we've been talking about since the days of Darwin and Thomas Malthus. In fact, Thomas Malthus's name has been resurrected in major media as being a hero that was misunderstood by big foundations like the Optimum Population Trust. They idolize him for his foresight, his early foresight in ways to stem off what he called overpopulation of basically the useless eaters, those who they don't need anymore for a post-industrial society. It's out in the open, and the public haven't got the message yet. They'll get it eventually, and they'll come to the right decisions that they've been planned to come to, and they will have no idea that they've never even reasoned through it for themselves. Their opinions are given to them by experts, once again, from the mainstream media. The problem really in this world is not the elite who do this. It's not all their helpers who push it forward. It's not just them by themselves. It's also the bulk of the brainwashed population which is a problem. They're like a symbiosis that work together, masters and slaves. Many at the bottom, and I'm sure everyone out there knows them. You'll meet them in the streets and so on. If you get into anything to do with politics or the future, how things are going to affect them, they don't want to know. See, these are the happy, governed people. It doesn't matter what flag you're flying, what system you're under, they're happy and they're governed. They're domesticated. So that that massive group is necessary for the elite to get their way. That's why they choose democracy, because they know that they can always count on that great mass of people to go along with any agenda they push forward. So the problem really is for those who are awake, and they're always in a minority. In all ages. All ages. If you look at ancient times, even in the New Testament of the Christian Bible, Jesus refers to the people who think they're alive because they walk around, but really they're under the dictates and the mind control of the priesthood. That was their complete reality, what came from the priests. And he called them the dead. That term has always been used down through the ages to the present time. Those who have never thought out anything for themselves and are quite happy with that situation are literally the dead. And they're like clones of each other. It doesn't matter what country you go to, they're interchangeable. They'll talk about what's on television, they'll talk about trivia, American Idol, and all the rest of it, but they don't want to talk about anything that's heavy, man. Well, that's heavy. I don't want to hear about that. And of course, all of the New Agers have been carefully trained and indoctrinated from a central capstone, regardless of the names of the organizations they've joined, are all trained to look away at the negative and only look at the positive. Same thing, you see, for a different group of people. Now, there's not an animal on this planet, not even an insect, that doesn't have survival instincts. They're called wild. Now, trying to get near a wild animal is difficult because the wild animal senses you're foreign to it, and or can also sense you have evil intentions to it. And they vamoos rather quickly away from you. They're always on the watch for other predators. We look at domesticated animals of today, the farm animals. That took hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of selective breeding, special breeding, and mating together to get passive animals to be easily managed and not too bright. And that's really the same as the general population. Those who accept the world as it's been handed to them, and they like Plato's cave, are the dead. And they will go along with anything, including their own extinction. That's what happens to domestic creatures. Domestication.
You remember, years and years ago, they tried different things too. The coming Ice Age was one of them. And they're harping, oh, too many folk are going to die in the Ice Age. You know? And that didn't quite pull off, you see. Nature had other... But then they went into, oh, the wetlands are disappearing. And then it was all, see, the first thing that humans do, like every other creature on the planet, even an amoeba, will change its environment to make it as sustainable as possible for its own sustainability, its own survivability. It'll change the immediate environment. No different than various animals go into fields now and start burying and make holes for themselves. They'll change the environment to suit themselves. Humans do the same, and they go into swamplands and things like that, and they'll drain it, you see. That way they're not getting eaten alive with poisonous mosquitoes that carry diseases, and you're healthier, and that's a good thing. But they've already said at the very top, you see, well, that also makes folk breed better and get healthier, and the death rate decreases, and they want to increase it all. That's what it's all for. Oh, my goodness, the wetlands are disappearing. All that nonsense, you see. Same bunch, same goals, same agenda. And they've used all dirty tricks all down through my lifetime and long before I was born. And it goes on. But unfortunately, they give themselves the power, you see. You don't elect them. And your government, being the good hands out, you know, pocketers that they are, sign everything into law when it's handed to them from these private NGO Soviet-type systems ruled by councils, unelected councils. They call themselves representatives of the people, but you've never even heard of them. And they're owned and bought and set up by the big private philanthropic organizations and funded by them. Mm-hmm. Well, on Thursday, Hamish passed away.
So for myself, it's good night. May your God or your gods go with you.